And for the last talk of the morning, the early morning session, is entitled Biological Enhancements in Speech Processing Depend on Bilingual Experience by Jennifer Kreisman, Jessica Slater, Viorica Marianne, Erica Sko, and Nina Kraus from the Northwestern University.
Good morning, everyone. I want to share some work that we're doing at Northwestern University looking at the neurobiological underpinnings of bilingual experience with a focus on the auditory system. For today's talk, I want to start by talking about executive function benefits in bilinguals because this is really the start of where we started thinking about looking at auditory processing in bilinguals versus monolinguals. Then I want to tell you a little bit about our biological approach, starting with some of the theoretical framework that we are starting from and also the methodology that we use to look at experience-dependent plasticity in the auditory system. And then I'll speak to bilingual auditory processing. And we've looked at this in two groups. One is adolescents, 14-year-olds from the Chicago public area, or the Chicagoland area. And the other are 8-year-old children from the greater Los Angeles area. And then I'll wrap up with some conclusions and just some of the possible neural mechanisms that we think are at play for the differences that we see between bilinguals and monolinguals. So a bilingual has been described as being a mental juggler of two languages. Given that during communication, both languages are presumed to be activated, and so one needs to be suppressed for communication to proceed. And this juggling two languages, it's been shown to enhance certain executive functions for bilinguals, especially bilingual children. And this is something that we've seen in our adolescent population as well. So now on this task, it's a 30-minute task where the participant will sit in front of a computer screen with a pair of headphones on, and they're instructed to click a mouse whenever a 1 but not a 2 is seen or heard. And so for this 30-minute time span, which is quite a long time to do this task, the participant will have to attend to both the auditory and visual modality because the 1s and 2s will vary in both rate of presentation as well as which modality they're presented in. And so this is a constant state of attentiveness. And we see that when the stimuli are presented in either the auditory or the visual domain, the bilinguals in red are outperforming the monolinguals in black on this task. And so what we presume this is representing is that the bilingual adolescents are better able to tune into relevant information over irrelevant information. And now given this enhancement in the ability to tune into relevant information, we wanted to see if this influenced the neurobiology. And we wanted to focus specifically on whether or not this influenced how bilinguals and monolinguals perceive sound. And our reason for wanting to look at the auditory system is because of what we know from animal work. And so, for example, if you play a tone to a rabbit and you measure from a single neuron in the auditory cortex, you have a response to this tone. Now, if you have the rabbit go through some type of training to associate this tone with a reward, say more food, then what you see is a huge jump in the response to that same sound. Now that it carries behavioral significance, you see a threefold jump in the response of that single auditory neuron to that tone, which suggests that the auditory system is capable of dynamically responding to sounds in its environment and adapting in ways that are behaviorally relevant. And the reason why this is possible is because the auditory system is hugely interactive and integrative. So although hearing begins in the cochlea, it doesn't end there. So as sound enters the ear and in the cochlea is translated into the electricity, which is the currency of the nervous system, it will ascend the auditory system through the brainstem into the midbrain and into the cortex. But in addition to this ascending signal, There is also a number of efferent or top-down projections extending from the cortex to the cochlea. And these will carry information from the executive system, like where to direct attention or where to focus the encoding of information, and also the limbic system. So like we saw with the rabbit, this is rewarding. Let's really focus on the stimulus. And the response that I'm going to be talking to you about today, the auditory brainstem response that we measure in humans, it represents the convergence of many of all of these levels of sensory processing. Now, to record the brainstem response, what we do, this is another ERP technique that we use, and so we apply three electrodes to the participant. We put one on the forehead, which serves as the ground, one on the top of the head, which is where we're collecting our neural activity in response to the stimuli, and one on the ipsilateral earlobe, which is serving as our reference. And what we do is we present a sound wave, in this case DAW, 6,000 times to the participant. It's less than 200 milliseconds, so it only takes about a half an hour, so it's not as time-consuming as it might seem. And what we do for those 30 minutes is we just record the electrical activity that is generated by that person in response to the stimulus. And we filter it to specifically isolate the brainstem contribution. So the brainstem tends to lock on to higher frequencies than what the cortex will. So we'll look from about 70 to 2,000 hertz. And what we see in our evoked response is that it looks strikingly similar to the sound wave that evoked it. And so we can also demonstrate this auditorily. So the brainstem response will really be able to capture the acoustic features of the stimulus. So what I'm going to play for you is a guitar riff that was made popular by Deep Purple, Smoke on the Water. The first part is Deep Purple. The second part, I'm going to brag a little bit, is my brainstem. So here we go. So when you actually play back the sound, the brainwave as a sound file, you can perceive the second half of the guitar riff from my brainstem. That's right. So not only does it capture these acoustic characteristics of the stimulus, but it can also capture its meaning. And I don't mean what this item is, but I mean what it means to us behaviorally. So for example, for someone who is listening to a guitar piece but doesn't have a lot of experience with the guitar, they might have a response that's going to be a little bit fuzzier and not as sharp and not locked onto all the acoustic features as well as someone who has more experience with the guitar. They might have a stronger representation to the second half of Smoke on the Water. And so we can, of course, we can also change these into sound files, and we can hear the differences between someone who has a lot of experience with something and someone who doesn't. So this is a five-note melody. Can everyone hear that? There we go. And what we're going to be comparing then are people without musical training and people with musical training, and you'll be able to hear the difference in the encoding just based off of the experiences that people have had. So then can you hear how the difference is a little bit more muted in the person who has no musical training, whereas the one with musical training, it's a bit sharper and louder. And so what we take this as is that the brainstem is sensitive to our experiences and can be shaped by the experiences that we have. And we see that it can be shaped on many time scales. So not only just music training, but what I'm going to talk about today is bilingual experience, and also short-term, such as auditory training paradigms, and online, which is where my future research is taking me, is looking at how the brainstem response can change during with a single recording session. And so the take-home point for this really is that experience can shape brain function within a lifetime, and that we're going to be looking at bilingualism as a model of we are what we do. And so to start off with looking at this idea of whether or not enhancements in tuning into relevant information over irrelevant information can shape how a bilingual hears, we're going to start with by looking at our 14-year-old participants. So half of these participants are monolingual English speakers, They report no exposure to other languages. And the other half of our participants are bilinguals. And these are all high proficiency English-Spanish bilinguals who reported learning both languages sometime between birth and 5 years, so either before school or in pre-K or kindergarten. Now, if we look at the response to the speech syllable da that we presented those 6,000 times to our kids, what we can see overall is that the bilingual response in red is just larger than the monolingual response in black. And now, instead of looking at this according to time, we can also look at this response according to frequency. And we see that the enhancement for the bilingual response is largely driven by enhanced representation of the fundamental frequency of the speech syllable. And now the fundamental frequency is a very important feature for speech because it can be involved in pitch perception, tracking an auditory object, and there is a bit of evidence to suggest that bilinguals may subtly change the pitch of their own voice during communication, which might aid as a potential language cue. And so one of the other things that we also wanted to look at was with this idea that a bilingual might be better tuned into a signal over a monolingual, we wanted to look at a measure of neural consistency. And so, as I said, we present this DA stimulus 6,000 times, and what we did is we looked at the average to the first 3,000 DA presentations, and we correlated it with the average to the last 3,000 presentations. And so if it's a more consistent response, it's going to be more highly aligned, whereas if it's a less consistent response, then the first half and the last half averages will be less aligned. And we calculate correlation values between this, so a more highly aligned response will have a correlation value closer to 1, whereas a more inconsistent response will have a correlation value that's closer to 0. So now what we can see for both the monolinguals and the bilinguals is that both groups really do have nice, consistent responses, but that the bilinguals have more consistency of their response relative to the monolinguals. And we can see this in a representative bilingual and monolingual subject, where we can see that there is much more overlap between the first half response in pink for the bilingual relative to the second half response in red, whereas for the monolingual, there is less overlap between the first half response in gray relative to the second half response in black. Now, what we were predicting was that because the bilinguals would be more tuned in to the relevant features of the signal and would have, therefore, a more consistent response over time, we are predicting that this may relate to their performance on that executive function task that I told you about earlier. And indeed, we do see this relationship where the more consistent the response, the higher the performance on that attention task. And this was a relationship that we only saw for the bilingual, not the monolingual participants. And we also saw that this related to language proficiency across the two languages. So the more proficient the child was in speaking English and Spanish, then the higher the response consistency. And so what we wanted to look at then was how bilingual experience may shape this neural signature. And to do so, we wanted to look at simultaneous and sequential bilinguals. So these are 8-year-olds from the Los Angeles area. And so the simultaneous bilinguals reported exposure to English and Spanish since birth. And the sequential bilinguals did not report exposure to English until they began school, so either preschool or kindergarten. So to put this in perspective, the simultaneous bilinguals have had twice the amount of time in a bilingual environment relative to the sequential bilinguals. And so what we can see when we look at these two groups is there is a trend for an enhancement of these executive abilities in the simultaneous relative to the sequential bilinguals. Now, this is a reaction time task. This isn't the same task that we did with the adolescents, given the age differences. But this is a reaction time test, so down is better, so you can see that the simultaneous are completing this task more quickly. And you can also see we presented the syllables ba and ga to these children, and you can see that, again, the response is larger overall in amplitude for the simultaneous relative to the sequential, just like the bilinguals versus the monolinguals. And again, if we look in the frequency domain, we can see that this enhancement is driven by an enhanced representation of the fundamental frequency of these two vowels. We also see that there's a trend for the simultaneous bilinguals to have higher consistency of their neural response relative to the sequential bilinguals. And so what we see this as is evidence of reinforcing the idea of a unique neural signature for bilingual experience that we saw in our adolescence, that is some constellation of executive function enhancements relating to an enhanced encoding of the fundamental frequency and greater consistency in their neural response. And so if you remember from the beginning of my talk, I said that the top-down connections exist in everyone because there are demands for everyone for communication of activation, co-activation within a language, and so we need to somehow control for that. But this added demand of potentially cross-linguistic activation for a bilingual may then preferentially strengthen this top-down connection in bilinguals to facilitate bilingual communication. I have a bunch of people to thank for all of the hours that went into each of these projects, and I would be remiss if I didn't invite you all to visit the website for more information. Start with slideshows.
Hi. This is really interesting work. The approach is fascinating. I was curious how you approached the issue of locking down other differences between the groups, right? So, for example, SES, maybe the bilinguals listen to Deep Purple more frequently than the monolinguals. You know, is there musical differences between the groups?
So these were all students who were selected from the Chicago public school system to participate in a longitudinal study looking at musical training. And so then all of these students had no music training prior to coming into the study. And all of these students were selectively recruited from low SES backgrounds.
Okay, so they're all low. Did they differ in musical ability? Because it seems like that would be...
No. So one of the criteria for participating in this study was that they didn't have any prior music training.
Okay, and would you expect these differences to be greater if the bilinguals had tonal languages versus not?
Absolutely.
Are you looking at that?
It's not something that we're looking at. There is some work from one of the labs at Purdue that has shown that tonal language speakers have an enhancement of the fundamental frequency. So it does seem as though this would happen, yeah.
Thank you.
This is really neat work. In your final experiment with the simultaneous and the sequential bilinguals, would you think that the effect is driven by difference in the age of acquisition or difference in a balanced exposure to the two languages?
That's a great question. I think one of the things that I went into the simultaneous sequential analyses not thinking that I would see anything because our adolescents fit into both of those groups. And so we see that by the time that the child is 14 years old, these enhancements exist to the same extent. And so there is no difference between someone who's acquired their second language at birth or someone who's acquired their second language by age 5. And so I think that it must just be time in a bilingual environment.
Yeah. Thank you.
And I'm not sure what that is. And so one of the things that I'm doing, my next project that I'm looking at is to try and answer that question. And so it's looking at the brainstem response during an active listening task where they're having to listen to two competing speakers, because I would predict that it would translate to gains for the bilingual speaker to be able to parse out those two speakers.
Well, I guess this ends.